So let me summarize a couple of things that we saw yesterday. So yesterday we were seeing a few instances of what we would call particles that are excitations around some vacua. Now, for example, when we have a spin chain, one such vacuum could be the ferromagnetic vacuum, which is the vacuum where all spins are pointing in the same direction. Okay, so if it's energetically favorable to align the spins, then this is what the vacuum will do, and the excitation would be a spin flip, one spin which is down in the sea of everyone being up. And then this spin will move in the ferromagnetic vacuum, and that's what we would call a magnon. Okay? If instead I would have an anti-ferromagnetic vacuum, which is a much more complicated state, as we said, it's a complicated entangled state of many, many cats, the excitation is also a more complicated beast, and it's called the spinon. And as we said, there is some cool physics there, where this spinon exhibits what's called fractionalization. That is, the fundamental move we can do in the Hilbert space is always to change the spin by one, because we flip a spin. That's the smallest thing we can do. So changes in the spin SZ component of my state, it must always be by integer units. However, these spinons, they carry half integer spin, which is something curious. And as we will see, that's because they are always produced in pairs, and that therefore it doesn't contradict this idea that the Hilbert space only changes by integers. But it's cool that you create some small excitation, change the spin by one, and then this spin breaks apart into two spinons, as we'll see tomorrow, hopefully. We saw other examples. We had the Sine-Gordon theory, where we had a scalar phi, where phi equal to 0 was the same as phi equal to pi. And then we could have these domain walls that would travel, and they would be stable, because it costs a lot to change from one vacuum to the other. And these domain walls are called kinks, and we can have kinks and anti-kinks. They can form bound states that vibrate, and we call them breathers. And these are all particles in the so-called Sine-Gordon model. And then we also saw some other model. For example, this very interesting sigma model, where we have just dn squared, where n is a unit vector. This model, if normally would say that what's the vacuum? N can point in any direction, right? N can be North Pole, South Pole, equator, any point. Any constant n looks like a vacuum. But we could change the direction, and that is also a good vacuum. So we would imagine that there could be Goldstone bosons associated to changing the vacua that would have zero mass. Like in higher dimensions, that would be the case. But because we are in two dimensions, and in two dimensions there are no Goldstone bosons, instead what happens is that these particles non-perturbatively acquire a mass through dynamical transmutation. It's a very small mass, but it's a mass nonetheless. And we have therefore not n minus 1 Goldstone bosons, but instead n very light particles, which transform in the vector representation, which we use this symbol of a box, which means that they have an index j that runs from 1 to n. And I also told you that in general, it can be much more complicated. Here is an example. We have the principal chiral field, dg dg, where g is a group element of SUN, which is what you would do if you would like to study a particle on a group manifold. And then if you have this, for example, this simple model, it looks very harmless, but it's a strongly coupled quantum field theory again. And particles, for example, they transform into the antisymmetric times antisymmetric representation under the SUN left and SUN right transformation that this section has. And there are, therefore, n minus 1 type of particles in this theory, which means a particle P has a set, a left set of indices, a right set of indices that are totally antisymmetric. Okay? And we also saw that there is a non-trivial mass for this particle that depends on k. Okay. So any question about this overview of what we have seen in the first lecture before I move to today's topic, which is basically what's called the algebraic beta ansatz, which is a technique for studying these magnons in full generality, which is a technique for understanding the spin chain that we saw in the first lecture in full generality. So any question before I move to that? Okay. So So we had this Hamiltonian, nearest neighbor Hamiltonian, and now I want to start today's lecture by a claim. At least the result should be clear. Right? So we have our Hamiltonian, and we start with a ferromagnetic vacuum, and we can ask, what is the energy for a given state with SZ component not equal to L over 2, which is what it would be normally, right? We would have L spins, everyone pointing up, that gives L over 2. And then each time we flip a spin, we lose 1, so minus N. Okay? There are many such states, but I'll tell you what their energy is. This is the spectrum of the spin chain. So this here will be the number of magnons that we will put in our spin chain. So yesterday we worked out the case with 1 magnon. Now I'm telling you the result right away for N magnons. And of course, I mean, it goes without saying that there exists many such states, right? Obviously, I mean, the dimension of the Hilbert space, as we said, is 2 to the L, right? Because at each site we can choose to have a spin up or a spin down. So of course there are many, and we will see where these many come from. But let me tell you, so the energy of this state is equal to a sum from J equal 1 up to N, lambda, and lambda was the coupling. If it was positive or negative, the spin chain was ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic, uj squared plus 1/4. Okay? So this is what it is, where, now I have to tell you what these uj's are, where the uj's obey a set of algebraic equations that take the following form. Uj plus I over 2 over uj minus I over 2 to the L times the product over k not equal to j, there are n of them, uj minus uk minus I over uj minus uk plus I equal to 1, and there is one equation for each j, j equal 1 up to n. Okay?
Where does this equation come from?
This is what I'm, this is just a claim, and I'm going to explain, yeah. I'm going to explain. So these are basically a set of polynomial equations. They don't look polynomial, but of course I just multiply everything by the same denominator to this side, and they become a set of polynomial equations. And as such, of course, they have many solutions. And that's fine because there are many states. So the many states that we have here correspond to the many solutions of these polynomial equations. Okay? So that's the claim. And now, of course, there is the question of deriving this. So what we are going to do now, we are going to do some mathematics. And this mathematics will provide a derivation of this claim. Right? And then, once I derive it, I would like to extract physics of these equations, out of these equations. Okay? So I hope to be able to start with the physics, where the physics comes from interpreting this equation. So what we will derive is pretty mathematical interpretation. But as we start interpreting this equation, and there's a lot of physics to be extracted out of it. Okay? But first, I would like to just derive these equations. But before deriving it, I would like to know if the main claim is clear. So you solve these equations. You can think of them as polynomial if you want or not. Right? Because you can just multiply the denominator here. Then they are a set of coupled polynomial equations of n variables. When you have a set of polynomial equations of n variables, each equation is an equation of degree L minus 1. Right? Because I have u to the L, or even more. It's u to the L, and here it's u to the n. I put it on the other side. It's also the same degree, but the maximum power is the same. So these are a coupled equations of degree u to the L plus n minus 1. And there are n of them. Okay? And now I could ask you how many solutions there are. But it would be a very nasty question because it's a very hard problem. It's not like I can just give you the degrees and you could compute right away the number of solutions. Okay? In fact, for example, if I change this sign and this sign, the number of solutions of this polynomial equation changes completely. So it just turns out that these equations have exactly the right number of solutions to correspond to the Hilbert space of H. Okay? But that's very far from obvious. It's not like you can just look at the degrees and say, oh, it's obvious. At least that check is correct. For example, as I said, if I change this sign here and this sign here, the number of solutions changes completely because it in fact describes another system with a different Hilbert space. Okay. So is the statement clear before I move on to the proof, which as I anticipated there, I will use some fancy techniques called algebraic Wittensatz, which is rather mathematical, but which will, at least for my taste, and but which turns out to be rather powerful. But it will be a kind of mathematics that you are probably not used to. It's a different style of, different kind.
So you're, just to be clear, you're saying that if I flip n of these spins from the vacuum, then I, in principle, get a lot of possibilities, and each will have different energies, and each of the energy will correspond to one of the UJs that I get from the solution.
I almost agree with what you said. You just be careful that I start with a ferromagnetic vacuum. That's an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. Mm-hmm. If I flip some spins, I don't get an eigenstate.
Right, yeah.
So the various eigenstates are linear combination of states that now have four spin flips. So four spins are down, everyone else is up. Mm-hmm. But four spins being down and everyone else up, there are many possibilities, right? There are binomial of them. I choose who is up and who is down, right? So there are that many eigenstates. But an eigenstate is a linear combination of those states. Each eigenstate is a solution to those equations.
Okay. So it's the,
Right? So if I find a list of solutions to these equations, that's the spectrum of the model. I can plot, that's the energy lines of the model.
So is there a result for eigenvectors as well?
There is. The answer is yes, yeah. I'm going to construct them now. Okay. So I'm going to write to derive this result and in the process derive the eigenvectors as well. Okay.
N equals 1 have no solution?
Can you repeat again? N equals 1?
Has no solution.
No, N equals 1 means this term is not here.
Yes.
Means that I have this is equal to 1, which means these are roots of unity. So how many are there? There are L possibilities, which makes sense because it's the L positions where I can flip the spin. Do you agree? So for one spin flip, it works, right? For one spin flip, we get L solutions to the roots of unity, and there are L possibilities for flipping the spin. So now you can do for two and see that it also works, but it's more complicated already. Very good. So first, I would like to start with a simple claim, which will introduce a lot of new notation. So let's write the claim and then digest it slowly. I want to say that the Hamiltonian, which I remind you was something like lambda sum of permutation, permuting sites n and n plus 1 minus the identity. Okay. So at each site, at each pair of sites, I either permute them or do nothing. And now I'm going to consider the case where my spin chain is closed. So I have a closed spin chain. So 1 and n plus 1 is the same. So I sum from n equal 1 up to L. Sorry, L. Okay? I sum from 1 up to L, and this was the Hamiltonian. Remember yesterday, at the end of yesterday, I told you to do this exercise. Hopefully not. It should be. This should be correct. Anyway, so. So the Hamiltonian plus lambda L times the identity. In other words, this part here, which is the interesting part, because the identity is just a shift anyway, right? So this is just a shift of the ground state. So this part, the sum of permutations here, can be written in the following way. Let me write it. Lambda over I derivative with respect to U. I'm going to write something, and then I'll put u to 0. And the something I want to write is trace over an auxiliary space 0. So this is an auxiliary space C2, so up or down, like a new spin that I'm introducing. And then I will have u times the identity, identity acting on which space? Acting on space 0, which is the new space, and physical space 1. So this is site 1 of my spin chain, plus I times the permutation that permutes the spin in the auxiliary space and spin 1, times the same thing, U times the identity acting on O2 plus I P O2, ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, until the end, U permutation acting on 0 L plus I times identity 0 L. Actually, this sounds wrong. So U equal to 0. No, it's okay. Okay. So this operator, you see, it's an operator that I wrote here inside that acts on all spins plus an auxiliary space. So this operator acts on more than the Hilbert space, but I trace over the auxiliary space. So now this big operator acts on the Hilbert space. I take derivative. After taking derivative, I put U equals 0. And I forgot something. There is a logarithm here. And logarithm of this operator, I will explain what it means. Okay, but it means, but yeah, I'll explain.
Did you mean to switch P and identity in the last factor?
Yes, thanks. So let me check that these formulas, let me fix the typos in this formula. U times identity plus I, P, 1 over I, lambda. Almost. Okay, so
how do we motivate this formula?
Well, for now I don't motivate. I'll just say that this is true. When I will, now that I will show that this is true, you will see that it doesn't require a lot of imagination to come up with it, as we will see how it goes. But I want to explain the notation here a little bit more. So there is a lot of notation here. So this object here, which is U, we could draw it. We could say that this is an object, which is U, times, if you have an auxiliary space, you would draw like this. You would say, this is my auxiliary space. This is my site L of my spin chain. And this is my site 0. And this means that there is the identity. So the L continues to be whatever it is. 0 continues to be whatever it is. Plus I. And then, I have to check who is incoming and who is outgoing in my conventions right now. Plus I times the permutation that permutes now these two sides. So, sorry, these two guys, they are permuted. So it means that whatever was in the physical goes to the auxiliary, and whatever was in the auxiliary space goes to the physical space. Okay? So this is the picture that I would associate to this object here. Okay? And this object, then, I could write it as just a blob with some dot in the middle if I want. Okay? And this object is called the R matrix. So it's an object, R, that depends on U, and it's a map from C2 cross C2 to C2 cross C2. Right? Where this C2, one C2 is the auxiliary space 0, and one is a site of the chain. And we can put an index L and 0, and then it's site L of the chain. Okay? So is it clear? So we have two C2s, and this acts by either not doing anything, either keeping the spins as they are, 0 continues to 0, L continues to L. Sorry, I should put the arrows like this. This continues, or they swap, because what was in the physical goes to the auxiliary, what was in the auxiliary goes to the physical, what was in the physical goes to the auxiliary. Okay? So this is how I would draw that term. Is it okay?
No.
No? So tell me what is unclear.
Can you switch the excitation from spin L to the auxiliary spin, then the number of spins is not conserved, but that is not a property of the Hamiltonian that you have given.
Yeah, but the fact that we take a trace solves that problem. Yeah. No. It's not obvious why this is the Hamiltonian, but it will become clear as I will show you. So, but I'm just asking about the definitions. Now, with these definitions, what is the full product that we have here? This full product, before taking the trace, let's digest it a little bit. The full product before taking the trace is then just a sequence where I multiply these R matrices together. I just multiply a bunch of them, and I have just a bunch of R matrices multiplied together from site L, L minus 1, up to 1. Okay? That's what this object is. And that object is what is called L. L. And because it's an auxiliary space, we put L0 of U. Okay? And then, when we take the trace, so now if we take the trace, we put what is the picture? We take the trace, so we are doing something like this. So we are multiplying them again, but then taking the trace. So this is definition, this is definition as well, and this is yet another definition. This is the definition of T, the so-called transfer matrix, that depends on U. And this transfer matrix, so this object here, is an it acts on what? This object, L, maps C2, which is the auxiliary space 0, times, and then all the sides, all the Hilbert space, into C2 times all the Hilbert space. And here, this is just a map from the Hilbert space to the Hilbert space. Okay? And then, what this equation is telling us is that what I want to say is the Hamiltonian is minus lambda over I. The inverse of this operator evaluated at 0 times the derivative of this operator evaluated at 0. And this is what I mean by log, by taking the derivative of the log. Right? So this, if this was a function, derivative of log is f prime over f. But you could ask, why did I choose to put the minus 1 here, not the minus 1 here? Or not minus 1 half here, minus 1 half here. They are operators, right? So why did I choose this definition? And the answer is it doesn't matter because they actually commute. So it's fine. But a priori, you could complain. Before I show that they commute, you could complain, why did I put this guy here and not here? But this is what I want to define as what this expression means with the log there. Okay? So let's verify that this equation is correct, because that's very simple, and it will give you some intuition about where these things are coming from. But for now, I want to ask if the notation is clear. We have three new objects. A fundamental building block R, which acts on a product of an auxiliary space and a physical space into the same spaces. A monodromy matrix, that's called, maybe I should write here, monodromy matrix, that acts on the full Hilbert space plus an auxiliary spin into itself. And the transfer matrix that acts on the Hilbert space into itself. Okay? Okay.
Question?
Yes.
The parameter U, is there any way to think about it? Like, because, you know, in the pictures, in the definition of R, you have kind of U going this way, and sometimes people write V going the other way as well.
Right. So here I don't want to associate U to this line. I mean, I could at some point start associating. I meant U times this diagram plus I times this diagram here. I did not mean to associate U to the line. Sorry. Any other questions? Now, you could ask, what is this U?
Yeah.
I mean, we put U to 0. What is this U doing? Okay. But that I'll postpone to the physics interpretation. There is some. But for now, it is just a parameter. I mean, here it disappeared, right? I mean, we already put it to 0. So For now, this auxiliary space and this auxiliary U are just trick, mathematical tricks. Okay. So let's see why this is the case. Let's see what is this object T. So you see that T at zero, what is this object T of zero? When I put U equal to zero, U equal to zero, right? I get a bunch of permutation operators. Permutation, 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 always permutations, right? So when I get U equal to zero, I can draw what happens. So I have my R matrix, the first R matrix becomes just a permutation. The second R matrix becomes just a permutation. The third R matrix, just a permutation, and so on. So you see what's happening, right? So this T is an operator that basically has this, this, let this be the last one, and then this line goes here, right? If this is a trace, okay? Where this would be site one up to site L. And there is some powers of I, right? So basically there is I to the power L, so 1 over I to the power L times T of zero is equal to this. So you see that T of zero is a very simple operator. It's the shift operator that shifts all spins one unit to the right. It just takes spin one, puts it at position two, takes spin two, puts it at position three, and so on. And takes spin L and puts it at position one. So it's the operator that rotates the chain by one unit, right? In other words, it's what we would normally say, e to the I times the total momentum operator, P, okay? So it's the operator that shifts the spin by one. So what is its inverse? What's the inverse of the operator that shifts everyone one unit to the right? It shifts everyone to the left. So T minus one, so we are starting to compute our first guy. T minus one of zero is equal to the operator that flips everyone to the left. Let's just draw the picture. So it would be something like this now. So it would be the operator e to the minus ip. I apply the inverse of this, so the inverse of this, there is some I to the. Good. Now, the next thing we have to compute is t prime of zero. What is t prime of zero? T prime of zero. It's almost permutations everywhere, except at one site where we get the identity. Because when the derivative acts here, we get the identity rather than the permutation. Everywhere else, we get the permutation. So T prime of zero is equal, or rather, we lose 1 over I to the power L minus 1 because the identity. So this T prime of zero is equal to a sum from k equal 1 up to L, because it can act on any of the terms. And then it's the same picture as in the upper left corner, except that at position k, instead of the permutation, we have the identity here. The spin just goes untouched. Right? So you see that if you take this expression and plug it here on top of this operator, if first you apply t minus 1 and then undo it back, what happens? You almost undo everything you did. So you see that you went to the right, you went to the left, so you did almost nothing, 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 except here, where you see that after this process, where was k now goes to position k minus 1, and k minus 1 ended up in position k. So what happens is that indeed, when I multiply both, I get the sum of permutations of sides n and n plus 1 as I promised. Okay? So it's correct. It's indeed true. Okay? So the key thing was that because r prime of 0 was basically the identity and r of 0 was the permutation, basically, these were the key things that led to this working, right? Up to some factor. Okay. Okay, so these were the two properties that we used here. Okay, so this first statement is correct. Okay. Now, the second statement, which is quite relevant, is the following. Is that these objects, T of u, if I take two of them, one with u and one with v, they commute. This is nice, because if this is true, and I'm going to show it now, it in particular means that I did not need to worry too much about how to define that log derivative. Because then, if this commutes, right, it means that t of 0 commutes with t of 0 plus epsilon. I mean, it means that they commute with the derivative. It means that that is totally well-defined, and I don't need to worry. Okay? So in other words, whenever I have functions of t, I can think of t as being numbers. And that definition there, I did not have to worry about it. Okay. And why is this true? This is a consequence of an identity that R obeys, which is the critical identity that R matrix obeys, which is that the R matrix obeys what's called the Young-Baxter relation. Young-Baxter, it's also sometimes called triangular relation. Which is a relation which in pictures takes the following form. So if I multiply three R matrices, okay, I multiply three R matrices in this way, okay? Namely, I have an auxiliary space, I have three spaces, let me call it auxiliary 1, auxiliary 2, and auxiliary 3. So this is an identity in C2 times C2 times C2. So by this picture, I mean the first R acts on 1 and 2, the second R acts on 2 and 3, the last R acts on 1 and 2. Again, right? This object is equal to this object here. Okay? Where I have to specify something, now I'm going to assign values. So this, I'm going to say this line is u, this line is 0, this line is v. And the arguments of the R matrix are read off from the difference of the lines. Let me write the equation and you will understand. So with all the indices, okay. So I want to write something that R acting at 1 and 2 of u times R, here I want to put minus v. So u minus v, u plus v, of u plus v acting on spaces 1 and 3 times R with argument v acting on spaces 2 and 3, this is equal to the same thing with the opposite order. R acting on spaces 2 and 3 of v times R acting on spaces 1 and 3 of u plus v times R acting on spaces 1 and 2 of u. Okay?
Did you mean U and V switched in the left hand side or?
U and V switched? No, no, I meant this. I meant it. This line is U, this line is 0, so the first one is this. Yeah. Let me just check if I like this picture. 1 and 2, a view, that's the first. And there, sorry, what am I doing? This is 0 and U, yeah. This, the first one is 0 and V.
So the from the left-hand side, if R1, 2, and U in the argument, and if I look at the picture on the left, the intersection between O1 and O2 is where R1, 2 is.
Ah, you are right. Sorry, sorry, sorry. This picture is wrong, yeah, sorry. Yeah, I put the labels in the bottom here. So U, 0, and minus V. Sorry, now it's much better, right? So 1 and 2 is U, as Tibra said. Then it's 1 and 3 with U plus V. And then 2 and 3 with V. Right, much better, good, thanks. And here the same, U, 0, minus V. The first one here is V. The second is U plus V. And the last one is 0 minus V, which is V. Okay? So again, imagine we put all U's and V's equal to 0. Then each of these guys is a permutation, right? So we just say, if we permute positions 2 and 3, then permute position 1 and 3, then permute position 1 and 2, you get the same if you do the permutations in that order. Something you can check. We put 3 people, you permute them in different orders, and you'll see that it's correct. Very good. So it's a, you can check, you can say it's experimentally proved. Okay, and this means that when that graphically, when we have lines crossing, we can move lines. You see what this is, identity is doing, is moving this line and putting it here. It's like moving this line, and it says that these lines, they are, if you want, topological in the sense that they can be moved around. Okay? Now, because they can be moved around, it means that the following identity is true. Let me write it. Which is that if I construct my L operator and I multiply two L operators, remember the L operator are the ones where the auxiliary space is open there. So I multiply them. And then I put at the end an R matrix here. Then if this line would have U, this line would have V, then this would be an equation of the form L of V times L of U times the arm L of V acting on some auxiliary space. Let's call it auxiliary space 2. U, let's call it auxiliary space 1. And then an R matrix that acts on 1 and 2 of U minus V. This is what this picture would make. Okay? This is equal. I can move one line, one by one, I can move these lines to the other side. So I can write that this is equal to this picture here. Which means that I just swap and I write O1, O2 of U minus V times L O1 of U L O2 of V. Right, so this is auxiliary space 1, this is auxiliary space 2. Which means that if I now take the, which means that I can multiply by R minus 1 and bring here R minus 1. Okay? And then take the trace and then apply the trace over the product O1 times O2 on both sides. Okay? Now, when I take the trace, what happens under the trace? Under the trace, this term cancels with this term because it's R and R inverse. So under the trace, cyclicity of the trace allows me to cancel them. And I have trace over two auxiliary space of something which is in the tensor product of the two spaces. That's the product of the traces, right? Trace over O1 times O2 of something in O1 and something in O2 is just the product of the two traces. So what I get, that this relation becomes just product of traces, which means T of V times T of U. That's what I get when I write product of traces here. One trace gives T, the other trace gives T. Equal to the same thing, but where now T is in the opposite order. T of U times T of V. Okay? Is it clear? So I'm just using the fact that trace over product of two spaces is product of traces. And this is indeed what we wanted to show, that these objects commute. Remember, these T's, they are operators on the full Hilbert space. So these operators commute with each other. T of U, T of V is T of V, T of U.
You did not use the about relation, the triangular relation for traces?
I used the triangular relation to derive this picture because line by line, I moved this to this side. I used this to move all these lines to this side, and now they are all on the right. Okay? So this is really a key relation. This Young-Baxter relation, or this picture here, I prefer the picture, I'll put a box here. Because one of the implications that this has, you see that because T prime of log derivative of T is the Hamiltonian, it means that we have an Hamiltonian that commutes with an operator that acts on the Hilbert space for any complex number V. So we just found an Hamiltonian, and we found another operator on the Hilbert space that commutes with Hamiltonian for any V, for V equals 0, for V equals 1, for V equals 2, I mean, for whatever V you choose. So that's very powerful because it's a conservation charge. It's a charge. It commutes with Hamiltonian, so it's a charge. But we found a family of charges because it commutes with Hamiltonian for any V. Right? Now, if you have an Hamiltonian in quantum mechanics, it's a matrix. Of course, you can diagonalize it. Of course, you can find many charges that commute with it. That's kind of trivial. What's interesting is if these charges are local, because then you would have a bunch of local charges commuting with your Hamiltonian. And you can easily convince yourself that if instead of taking one derivative here, for example, I will take n derivatives here. This would give other local Hamiltonians. Or charges, if you want, in the sense that these other Hamiltonians, let's call them Hn, would all commute with H. Okay? And in the exercise, in the afternoon, for example, you will be invited to construct a case where you have n equals to 2, where you take two derivatives and you check that indeed we get an Hamiltonian that is a nice local Hamiltonian. It's a bit less local than H in the sense that H only acts between nearest neighbors. When I have two derivatives, you will see that it acts next to nearest neighbors as well. And if it was three derivatives, it would be next to nearest neighbors. And the range increases a little bit, but it's always local. It's always a sum of something that acts on a finite support. Okay? But this is very powerful, because when you have an Hamiltonian and when you find a family of local charges that commute with it, it's a sign of some hidden symmetries of the model that are precisely the reason why we can solve the model exactly. Okay?
In this way, I will get n commuting Hamiltonians?
Sorry?
I will get n number of commuting
Hamiltonians? You will get n commuting Hamiltonians.
But not more than n.
More than n, it becomes a bit redundant because you have n degrees of freedom on your spin chain. So you can find more than n, but it will not be independent.
So the total number of conserved charges would be n, not infinity?
No, definitely not infinity, because the Hilbert space is finite. It's a finite matrix. I cannot find infinitely many linearly independent matrices of a given size, right? So, more questions? Okay, so far...
Question?
Yeah.
So you talk about them being local, but, like, they're not all local, right? Like, they all... Like, the nth one has has spun n. It burns
That's right.
N nearest neighbors.
Yes, yes.
But when n starts getting like system size, it's not really local anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
I mean,
it's local in the sense, what's a local Hamiltonian? I mean, mathematicians will say local Hamiltonians, and Hamiltonian is just a sum of some Hamiltonian density where the Hamiltonian density acts on a finite number of spins, blah, blah, blah. This is true. If I take 10 derivatives, it acts on 10 on the 10 nearest neighbors, not on L of them. Of course, if I start taking the number of derivatives to be comparable to the system size, then yes, but okay. In principle, that's not something I'm interested in doing. L is going to be very large, and the number of derivatives is going to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10. At some point, if you have 10 local charges, you are already very happy. You don't care about many more, as you will see. One is actually enough normally. Okay, very good. So far, the key properties of this construction is the introduction of an object called R matrix that obeys the triangular relation. So that's ingredient number one, if you want, very important. And ingredient number two was that at some special points, the R matrix becomes simple. It simplifies. With these two properties, what we could do so far is explain, is unveil the existence of an infinite set or a large set of conserved charges. Okay, but we did not compute the spectrum yet. So now I'm going to tell you how to go about computing the spectrum using these same ingredients. Okay? So, I mean, I think if you will study then this at home, you'll see, I mean, each step is kind of simple, but it's, as I told, it's a language that you are probably not very used to, with all this auxiliary space, tracing over auxiliary spaces, and so on. Perhaps if you do quantum information, it's trivial, but for most people, all these spaces, people get a little bit confused, so... Please do stop me if you have any question here. Now let's see again, what is this L operator, L of U? So L of U, as we said, it acts on the product of the of C2 times the Hilbert space into itself, right? Into C2 times the Hilbert space. So I can think of this object as a 2x2 matrix where I have four elements here that act on the Hilbert space, right? So I'm making the auxiliary space manifest, but the physical space, I leave it here, right? So this object would be, I call it A, the first element, and I want to define, to call it A of U plus I over 2, and this object would have some indices, I1 up to IL, J1 up to JL. So this would be the element when I act with spin up in the auxiliary space and I get spin up in the auxiliary space. Similarly, there would be here a B of U plus I over 2, another operator that acts on the full Hilbert space, a C, and a D. Okay? A And therefore, T of U that we defined is just A of U plus I over 2 plus D of U plus I over 2, just the trace. Okay? Any questions? Now, our goal is to find the states psi which diagonalize T of U, such that T of U acting on psi give some function T of U, I remove the hat, acting on psi. Notice that if we solve this problem, and if I know this eigenvalue, by definition, I solve the problem of the Hamiltonian. I just, the energy, right, the energy spectrum would just be minus lambda over I times the derivative of log of this function T of U at U equal to 0, right? But I can solve it because they commute, T of U and T of V commute. I can find these eigenvectors for any u. The same eigenvector diagonalizes all transformations at the same time because they commute with each other. Okay? Any question?
What's the significance of I over 2?
The significance of I over 2, let me see if I can explain it in some simple way. There's no significance. One thing I can say is that if you were to write that P as product of sigma matrices because of the identities and these factors of 2 of last lecture, you would shift things by I over 2, and that I over 2 makes things nicer in that language. But it's related to unitarity, as we'll see. But if you want, you can ignore this shift here. It's not very important for now. It is just anticipating some nice equations that will come about. I want them to be more real, so I put this shift here. Okay, more questions? Okay. So you see that this operator here, again, what is this operator here? It's the operator where in the auxiliary space, we act with spin up, and we receive spin up, right, in the auxiliary space. And this is the one where we act with spin down, and we receive spin up, and so on. So this guy, because we inject a spin up and remove a spin up, it preserves the number of spins. And this guy, because we inject a spin down and receive a spin down, it preserves the number of spins. So this object preserves the number of spins. Okay? So this addresses the complaint that someone asked in the beginning, that this P doesn't preserve the number of spins. Right? So here now it does, because I inject a spin and I remove the same spin on the other side. But this one's no. This one, I inject a spin down and I remove a spin up. So this object increases the number of spins by 1. And this object decreases the number of spins by 1. Do you agree? So this object has the same quantum numbers as sigma minus, and this one has the same quantum numbers as sigma plus. Right? So the ansatz that we are going to make, it turns out that a good ansatz to make is to try to find psi using these B operators at some specific values, U1, up to un, acting on the vacuum where everyone is up. Okay? This has everyone up. This has the quantum numbers of lowering a spin. So I'm going to try to build eigenstates of this form. You could ask, are these old eigenstates or not? But let's first try, just let's try to see if this could work. Yes?
So the interpretation of rating and lowering operator is on the auxiliary spin, right?
the auxiliary spin, what we are saying here, so the full object preserves the number of spins. Because at what happens is that you have either identity or permutation.
Right.
So the number of spins doesn't change. If we inject a spin down and remove a spin up, it means that from the auxiliary space point of view, we are increasing the spin.
Right.
So from the other, we must be lowering the spin in the physical space. Right? Because you see, you started with a bunch of spins, and here you put a spin down and receive a spin up. So that spin must go, spin down must go somewhere here in the middle. It cannot just disappear. So the state that you get after acting has one more spin down. So this has quantum numbers of spin down. Okay. So how do we check if some guess for this is correct? So we want to try to check it. So we construct A of u plus I over 2 plus D of u plus I over 2. This is our T. And we want to act on this object on B of u1, B of un, acting on the vacuum. So clearly, we need two things. We need to know the algebra of these operators, because what we want to do is start commuting these and acting them on the vacuum. And D and A, they don't change the number of spins. So when they act on the vacuum, they give back the vacuum times some number. So I just need to know what's the action of these operators on the vacuum, and how do they commute with the B such that they reach the vacuum. Okay? So we need to know the action of A, B, C, D on the vacuum, and we need to know the algebra of A, B, C, and D. If we know these two things, we can now start manipulating these objects. Okay? Okay, so let me see, where do I have the picture? Okay, it's there. Okay, so let's see what's happening here. So we are saying that we have this object, right? And we put the vacuum here. Everyone spin up here. Huh? And we want to know what happens with A, B, C, or D. What is A? A means that I insert up here and put up here. So this would be the picture that I would draw for A. Now, of course, at each intersection, let me see, I drew it like this. So at each position here, whether I use the identity or the permutation, it doesn't matter. I get a spin up here and a spin up here. Because either permuting or not, an up and a down, I get the same thing. Here the same. Whether I use identity or permutation, doesn't matter. I get an up here and an up here. So everyone is up everywhere in this picture. And when everyone is up, what does this term give me? This term, identity, gives me u. Permutation gives me I, but because this is A of u plus I over 2, if I want this to be A of u, I subtract I over 2. Okay? So this, from this picture, we see that A of u acting on the vacuum is equal to u plus I over 2 to the power L acting on the vacuum. Okay, let's try to do now the picture let's try to do the one for D. Now for D, I have spin down and spin down. So this would be now D of U. Right? So what could be going on here? I have a spin, let's start looking from this side. So these two guys are coming in. An up is coming in, and a down is going to go there. So for sure, here there is a down. Right? So there is a down spin here, and then there is an up spin here. And then here I have a spin up, and here I have a down. Well, then for sure there is a spin down here, and a spin up here. Right? Remember that in this notation, when we have this notation, these guys are incoming and these guys are outgoing, and the number of spins is preserved. So when I look here and I see there is a down here, I know that here must be a spin up, so I know that there must be a spin down here. Okay? And I know everyone is up here because of conservation. So up is down is here, it must go somewhere. So I know that basically what happens is that I have spins down everywhere and spins up everywhere. So now each intersection instead gives me just U, because I just use the identity, never the permutation. But because this is for A plus I over 2, now it's U minus I over 2 if I want for D of U. So D of U acting on the vacuum give me U minus I over 2 to the power L acting on the vacuum. C of U acting on the vacuum gives me 0 because C is a raising operator, which we can again also see. Let's draw another picture because it's becoming complicated, that one. Right, if I put all spins up here and I see I'm injecting a spin up and here it's a spin down, then I'm done because these two are incoming. So here I have up, up. These two are incoming. I have up, 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 and here I reach a contradiction. See, namely, you see that these guys are the incoming ones, right? And these guys are the outgoing ones. So I cannot just start with all up and get one down and whatever is here, it's impossible. I'm already destroying spin conservation. So this guy is zero. And B of U acting on the vacuum is equal to something non-trivial, but I don't care what it is. I just care that it's something non-trivial, because after all, we are claiming that B of U acting many times is exactly the state we want. Okay, so now it's perfect. So if A and D could reach the vacuum, I can eliminate them and replace them by some numbers. Okay? And you start seeing that this U plus I over 2 to the L, U minus I over 2 to the L, starts already to resemble the equations that I wrote in the beginning. You see, there is the U plus I over 2 to the L, U minus I over 2 to the L there. Okay? So in those equations here, we are already seeing some ingredients of things that are appearing here. So here we just solve this action. So let's see now the algebra. Right, so now we need to know how to commute A and B and so on. Okay. This algebra is what's called the Fadev's homologic of algebra. Fadev's homologic of algebra. And can be derived basically from that relation that we wrote here, maybe. No. From the relation that is here in this blackboard. From this relation here, LLR equal RRL. Okay? So let's be a bit explicit just to make sure that we understand everything we are writing here. Okay. So let's write down that equation there explicitly. Let's write down this equation here. So I will write it again. So we have L acting on auxiliary space 2, a V times L acting in auxiliary space 1, a U times R, O1, O2, a U minus V equal to the same expression when written in opposite order. Good. So let's see. So what is this L? This L is a 2x2 matrix in the auxiliary space O1. And what is this L? L is an auxiliary matrix, 2x2, written in O2. And what is this R? R acts in O1 and O2. So if I want to make O1 and O2 manifest, I cannot just use 2x2 matrices because I have two auxiliary spaces. I must use 4x4, where the 4x4 matrix will be up, 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 down, down, up, down, down, where these spins are the two auxiliary spins from O1 and O2. So for example, these are matrix. Let's write it down as a matrix, a 4x4 matrix, where I have here up, 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 down, down, up, and down, down, just to be explicit. What is it? R is identity plus permutation. So this guy, identity and permutation both contribute. So I get here U minus V plus I. When I act with down, down, I get back down, down, both from identity and form permutation. So U minus V plus I. Now, if I act on up, down, from identity, I get back the same. And here, from identity, I get back the same. Identity is the one with, no, identity is the other one. So I get the same. So I put U minus V, and here U minus V. And when I act when up, down, I can get down, up by the permutation. So I get I, I, and zero on everyone else. Okay? So again, maybe I should do the following. I should say, nah, it's okay. Okay? So this is this 4x4 matrix. What is this LO1 in this language? Let me write it and then we'll see if you agree. This guy here and this guy here would be 4x4 matrices where one auxiliary space is spectator. So here I have O1 tensored with the identity in O2. So this matrix is the following, is the matrix here. I'll write it A of U 0, B of U 0, 0, A of U 0, B of U, C of U. And this one is A. Okay, so here it's V, here it's U. So here notice what, so what is this? So this is the matrix where we have identity tensored with A, B, C, D. And here is the matrix where we have A, B, C, D tensored with a 2x2 identity. Right? So that second one means whenever you see an element, put the identity there. So you take A and you open it up, B and you open it up, and so on. So that's when the identity is after. And here it's the opposite. You take the identity, which is 1, 1, and instead of the 1, you put the matrix. So that's what you get this. Right? Is it clear? And now you see what you get here. Now you get an algebra. Because this gives me some operator, for example, this equation will give me, let me write some relation that we'll get. So this implies 16 relations. Oops, sorry. 16 relations, where 16 are the 4 times 4 elements of each side, that are the algebra relations we are after. Let me give you an example. For example, we get that A of V times B of U, exactly what we need to know how they commute, is equal to F of u minus v, b of u, a of v, that's how they commute, plus g of u minus v, b of v, a of u, where they also commute, but now they swap the arguments, you see? Notice the arguments, they commuted, but now b and a, they swap their argument. But still, a now is to the right, which is great. Because A, acting on the vacuum, I don't care about its argument. I know how A acts on the vacuum for any argument. So this relation is great. It allows me to start passing the A through the B until the A hits the vacuum. And we get other relations. We get other relations. In the tutorial today, you will be asked to implement this and rewrite them. For example, one which is quite important is that the B's commute. And we get many other relations. And this is an algebra. You see, it's not a Lie algebra. It's a more complicated algebra. It tells us how to commute the operators through. I have to tell you where what this f is, where f of u is 1 plus I over u, and g of u is I over u. Okay, so now we can go on and commute A through the B's until it hits the vacuum, right? So let's suppose I use this first part of the relation only, where A goes through the B and I pick an F. If I just use the first part of the relation, I would get the following. I would get a product of f of u plus I over 2 minus uj, product over j. Right? Each time a commutes, I pick an f. Then a acts on the vacuum. When a acts on the vacuum, I get u plus I over 2 to the power L. Okay. And this would be multiplied by the same state psi. Okay. Plus, if I compute the action of D using the same first term for D, let me write like this. This is from A. This here is from A. If I would use the same idea from D, from the analog first term in D, I would get the complex conjugate of this expression. Just flip I's to minus I. This would give me back the state psi. Plus, so if this was just this, it would be perfect. Plus what we call undesired terms. Where what are these undesired terms? They are terms where I don't use just this relation, but sometimes I use this. So if I use this sometimes, it means that when the A reaches the vacuum, one of the B's now carries the argument of A. So I don't get back the state, but these undesired terms, they are basically a sum with some coefficients, alpha k, of states where I have b of u1, b of uk, and uk is not there, up to b of un, and who is instead of uk is b of u times the vacuum. So this is definitely not good, because I don't get back the same state. So what I would like to do is set this alpha case to 0. And how many do I have? I have n of them. And these equations that set the alpha k to 0 are the equations that I wrote in the upper right corner. Okay? So that's how we finish So set alpha k to 0, this implies the equation in the upper left corner. Now, I'm not doing this in detail, finding these terms and imposing that they are 0. I could, if you want, I can. But I want to do a shortcut. I want to say, let's assume I can cancel them. Right? Suppose I can cancel them. Suppose I can cancel them. Then this would be the eigenvector, the eigenvalue. Right? Then this quantity here, if I can cancel them, this quantity here is this t of u. Right? So this is the eigenvalue of t of u. Right? But now you see that there is a small problem. Because this eigenvalue of t of u, what is t of u? It's a matrix which is a polynomial in u. Because t of u, remember, we just multiplied together many u plus i, u plus i, u plus i, u plus i. It's a polynomial in u. And we diagonalize this polynomial in u, polynomial matrix. But f is 1 plus I over u, so it contains poles when u is equal to uj minus I over 2. Right? So this guy has poles. Okay? So this is a paradox, because we diagonalize a polynomial and now we have some poles. So the way out is we go to this expression and we impose the condition that the residue of t is equal to 0, such that these are not real poles. And this gives me the equations in the upper right corner as well. Okay? So this is a shortcut where I don't need to compute these alphas if I want to guess those equations there. Okay? Okay, tomorrow I'll summarize and move to the physics part. Okay, today was high. I'm going to be gentler tomorrow. Yeah, today was tough. I know. Yeah.